This map in front of you here is drawn from a study that was published by David Holchansky at the Toronto City Centre, and it was called The Three Cities Within Toronto, Income Polarization Among Toronto Neighbourhoods from 1970 to 2000. So if you look at the map, it vividly documents the spatial dimension of the growing income inequality in the region. In this period, we see the consolidation of north-central Toronto, so that's the area in blue and white, as an elite enclave, while the inner suburbs of North York and Scarborough have been transformed from middle-class neighbourhoods into low-income areas. Downtown Toronto has also experienced a dramatic transformation in this period, as primarily working-class neighbourhoods gentrified, creating a patchwork of wealthy, middle-income, and poorer neighbourhoods. I live in one of the low-income parts of town. In my neighborhood, the average income is between 20 to 40% below the census metropolitan area average, and it has been fairly stable over time. Nevertheless, as a high-income homeowner in a low-income neighborhood, I am a gentrifier. I am one of those people who is contributing to the growing income polarization and potentially the eventual cultural transformation of my neighborhood. This has motivated me to ask the question of this paper: what is wrong with gentrification? You can see the payday place where I cash my check every week. So in the paper, I start off by defining gentrification and discussing some different definitions. And in the end, I settle on a very concise definition offered by Jason Hackworth, who called gentrification the production of space for progressively more affluent users. But I think a key question when we talk about the definition of gentrification is whether we have to see it as a multi-stage process that culminates in the consolidation of an elite neighborhood, or if instead it's possible for gentrification to consolidate in a stably mixed income neighborhood. So then I mapped or looked at the extensive secondary literature on gentrification to try and understand what people who write and think about this see as the harms. And I identified five different harms, and I've grouped them into three categories in my mind. The first one is the most obvious: residential displacement. You know, landlords raise the rent, the number of rental units declines because of a conversion to single-family homes, and people are forced out. The second harm is exclusion. The empirical literature, which I review in the paper, suggests that, in fact, residential displacement is not really that widespread for lots of reasons that I could talk about. So often, neighborhood transformation actually happens through exclusion. People move or sell, and then similarly situated people are not able to move in. So new immigrants, working class people are not able to access these neighborhoods as they become more expensive. So you'll notice that both of these harms are really individual harms. But when you study gentrification, you'll realize that that's not really the only loss that people experience. It's not just the loss of their own individual residential unit, but instead the transformation of public, social, and commercial space. So I try and look at this in terms of group rights, whether it's possible to think about a group right to a neighborhood with a certain ethos, with a certain feeling of community and a certain kind of character. And then the last two harms, polarization and homogenization, these I think are really structural characteristics. They aren't really harms in the sense that it's not, we're not concerned about the process, but instead the outcome. What type of urban environment is created at the end of a process of gentrification? So I discuss all of these in the paper, and I'd be happy to talk about all of them in questions and answers. However, I think I'm going to focus largely on the first one, on residential displacement. Okay, so the question again is, do current residents and or non-resident poor people have a legitimate claim to housing in high-cost downtown neighborhoods, and does this claim imply an obligation on the part of other people or on the government to provide it? And I think there have been a number of answers to this question. One of the most influential is the libertarian approach, which was articulated quite clearly by Friedrich Hayek in his essay on cities and town planning. And he said clearly no, that there is no obligation to provide subsidized housing in cities. His argument was that this would distort the free market, that some poor people's labor does not produce enough value in order to cover the high cost of living in cities, yet they would be self-supporting if they remained in rural areas. And so he felt that by subsidizing housing, you would be creating an excess of demand over supply, and you would need some mode of allocating housing. So if you didn't use the market, as imperfect as that might be, you would be forced to use a more authoritarian or authoritative mode of allocation. And so he was critical of this distortion of the market. Now, while this might not be a popular argument in academic circles, I think it's very influential in public policy. To give you just one example, recently, a few years ago, one of the city councilors in Toronto, Case Oates, proposed that the Toronto Community Housing Corporation, which is the public housing housing corporation, should sell a number of houses that it owned. And these houses had been purchased at a low cost when these were working class neighborhoods. They had gentrified and the houses were now worth $700,000 or $800,000. And the argument was you could sell them, displace the residents to lower cost areas on the urban periphery, and use that money to try and pay for the backlog of repairs to these high-rise towers that were in terrible disrepair. And so, you know, I talked about this with a lot of friends and with students. You know, what's wrong with, you know, selling these houses to raise money in order to help a larger number of people, right? You could increase the standard of living of a large number of poor people rather than having a few people in these high-cost housing. And interestingly, Joe Heath in his book Rebel Cell, I think, made an argument sort of along these lines, although for a different purpose, where he pointed out that academics would be very ashamed to engage in conspicuous consumption, driving a Ferrari to work. But by living in a high-cost downtown neighborhood, in fact, the opportunity cost of doing that is like $100,000 or $200,000. So your 10-minute walk to work, you're paying $200,000 for. Yet we don't experience that as conspicuous consumption, but it is. So in a sense, living downtown then is an expensive taste. And because I think this is a interesting concept, it's been explored most fully, I think, in the literature on luck egalitarian theory. And so while that's not really the genre that I usually read or write in, I was drawn to it in order to think about this question. So for people who are not familiar with luck egalitarian theory, the main idea is that in pursuing equality, we must compensate people for inequalities that are caused by bad luck. And so an example in this would be, you know, let's say we should provide equal resources to educate all children, yet if you have a learning disability and you need special help, no fault of your own, you should get extra resources. So that's the basic idea there. So within this debate on luck egalitarian theory, there was a debate between Jerry Cohn and Ronald Dworkin about expensive tastes. And in this debate, Cohn argued that individuals should receive extra resources in order to satisfy expensive tastes, as long as those tastes were not acquired intentionally. So I put up here the definition of expensive tastes because it's important. A person with expensive tastes needs more income than others simply to achieve the same level of welfare as those with less expensive tastes. Now this is important because you should note the differential aspect. If everyone equally prefers A over B and A costs more, then it is not an expensive taste. So I take this then to be a reworking of the socialist principle, to each according to his needs, but transposed into the language of Anglo-American normative philosophy. For Cohen, it's a matter of bad luck to have expensive tastes, and therefore a consistent application of luck egalitarian theory requires that people be compensated for them. Now, I know this probably sounds nuts to most people, but in order to make it seem more plausible, Cohen notes that sometimes it's difficult to distinguish between a disability and an expensive taste. Take the example of Percy, a man who, unfortunately, whenever he drinks tap water, because of some sort of problem with his taste buds, it tastes unbearably sour to him. So he has to drink bottled water. In a certain sense, choosing bottled water is a choice. He would not become terribly ill if he drank regular water. But in another sense, it has a great deal in common with other disabilities that do justify special compensation to overcome disadvantages. So Ronald Dworkin responds to this by distinguishing tastes that the individual affirms, things like being a wine enthusiast or enjoying skiing, and tastes that the individual would prefer not to have. So Percy, presumably, if he could take a pill that would magically, you know, solve this problem with his taste buds, would make water taste normal rather than sour, would choose to take the pill. So Cohen addresses this objection in the following way. He says, true, many people strongly identify with these tastes, the wine enthusiast, the skier. But we have to distinguish between what he calls bad price luck and bad preference luck. Yes, people would not give up their tastes, but they would prefer if these tastes were less expensive. They have bad price luck in that the things they prefer are more costly than the things that other people prefer. So to give you an example, I enjoy watching what I would consider to be high quality serial television shows. And if I was given a, let's say, lobotomy, that would make me prefer reality TV. I would not choose to be lobotomized. But if I could instead take, you know, a magic wand and turn everybody who now likes reality television into fans of HBO type series, and thereby drive down the costs so you wouldn't have to subscribe to HBO and it would be free on network TV, I would do that. So in that sense, by preferring HBO, I do not feel like I have bad preference luck, but I have bad price luck because my preferences are more expensive than the preferences of other people through no fault of my own, right? So Dworkin denies this difference. He says, if you don't have market prices, there's no way of really allocating anything, and you can't really consider that a matter of injustice. But Jerry Cohn disagrees. Now, if I had read this debate without thinking of gentrification, I have to admit I might have been convinced by Dworkin. But when I thought about gentrification, I realized that Jerry Cohn, in fact, is right. Poor people who wish to remain in gentrifying neighborhoods are classic victims of bad price luck. These residents could not be reasonably held responsible for the expensiveness of their tastes. After all, they're the ones who moved into a low-cost neighborhood. These original residents acquired an attachment to a working-class neighborhood, which, due to the structural incentives of capital and the locational preferences of the creative class, subsequently became expensive. Now recall that expensive tastes are not merely luxuries that everybody desires, but something that certain people need more than others in order to have the same level of well-being. And this describes the preferences of current residents of transitional neighborhoods. Many people may desire to live downtown, but long-term residents develop a particularly intense emotional attachment or sense of place that would be painful to disrupt. So how does this come about? In the paper, I briefly discuss some different modalities, territoriality, topophilia. This is a term coined by Yi Fu Tuan, who said topophilia emerges from things like visual pleasure, sensual delight. People feel fondness for home because it is familiar, it incarnates the past, it expresses the pride of ownership. Residents also become attached to a place because of the benefits of informal community support. People who live in proximity to one another create networks, and it makes it efficient for neighbors to collaborate on mutually beneficial projects, such as looking after each other's children, sharing tools, fostering safety through eyes on the street. These projects require trust and social capital that takes time to build. And if tenants are forced to relocate to another neighborhood, these networks of mutual aid are disrupted, which entails a financial cost as well as emotional hardship. So then, imagine a place, a town I call Sufficientlandia. In Sufficientlandia, public policy is structured so that low-income residents receive a supplement which enables them to pay the average cost of rent. The question then is, should people who live in gentrifying neighborhoods, so places where market rents used to be below average but are now above average, receive a supplement that enables them to pay the new higher than average rent? This is not just a hypothetical example, because it is what is exactly at stake when public housing decides where corporations decide where to build public housing. And I think Jerry Cohn gives us a good reason to say, yes, we should pay a supplement, because displacement is a real harm that people suffer. Okay, so what then about non-residents? I hope I've made a compelling argument why we should be concerned about the displacement of residents. So in the paper then, I talk next about exclusion and about the claims that people who don't live in neighborhoods might have also to live there. So it might be tempting to say, well, of course, the non-residents do not rely on the same place-specific networks that residents do. They don't have the same attachments and loyalties that are produced through histories, routines, and experiences that are connected to a particular place. They did not participate in the creation of the oeuvre of the neighborhood. But then I have to ask myself, is that really true? There's many new immigrants to a city that would have a strong preference to live in an ethnic enclave where there's a dense network of ethnic businesses that facilitates work, socializing, and the logistics of everyday life? And what about other people who share a preference for downtown living? So I think this brings us back to Hayek's point, which is that there will be a demand that outpaces supply, and some form of authoritative allocation is necessary. But rather than seeing that as a problem, I see that as a good thing, and I suspect that's exactly where Jerry Cohn wants to end up. From a normative perspective, we cannot simply abdicate the responsibility for this decision by relying exclusively on market forces. Democratic institutions are sites where we can consciously decide how to weigh competing priorities, the productivity of the market, the desire for freedom, and the requirements of justice. I think there are no philosophical principles or mathematical formulas or invisible hands that will solve this for us. As citizens, we will have to provide reasons to explain why certain needs have priority rather than simply deferring to the market, which allocates all goods on the basis of economic power. So, since I'm out of time, I'm going to take just 1 minute to tell you the arguments, to just sketch the arguments in the rest of the paper so that people can discuss them in questions and answers if they want to. In the next section, I address the question of whether there's a group right to space and a harm that occurs when there is a transformation of public and social space. And here I draw on the very interesting work of Avery Kohler's and his suggestion that there are certain ethnogeographic communities that have territorial rights. But I conclude that this is not, well, it's a very interesting framework from a critical perspective. It's not that useful for gentrification because there aren't really ethnogeographic communities in urban neighborhoods. They're very, very diverse places where people have very different conceptions of property. I also worry that these small neighborhood-based territorial rights, if expressed institutionally, could be used by elites to really reinforce an exclusive neighborhood and to exclude outsiders. I have to skip the photo. Oh. And the last thing then was the two structural harms of income polarization and homogenization. And here I examine the empirical record and show that gentrification or suggest that gentrification happens in really different ways in different places. So it's very hard to generalize about it. But as far as the issue of polarization, which is really the problem I started with when I presented the map of Toronto, I mean, I think here we have to recognize that polarization is not really an issue of cities, it's an issue of the broader polity and the growing economic inequality. This is something that I think we should be very concerned about, but I don't think that the concern is with the way it's expressed in neighborhoods, but income inequality, rising income inequality in general, and so we have to address it at that level. And the final point is that often in discussing the harms of gentrification, people will come out either in favor or against the idea of social mix. And I examine the arguments in favor of and against social mix, but I conclude that instead of seeing things in terms of social mix, we should really examine the issue in terms of power. In a given context, is a greater mix or is another sort of more kind of concentrated ethno-burb type structure going to lead to greater power for the disenfranchised or less power, and that maybe that's a more useful framework for examining the transformation of neighborhoods.
I have a, thank you for your talk. I have a question about you said that for the five harms, there are some harms where you look more on the outcome than the process. And then you looked at displacement, and I had the impression that you were looking also at the outcome of displacement more than the process, because on your analysis of expensive taste and what are the consequences also of displacement on certain population, I had the impression that it was more outcome analysis than a process analysis, because when people are displaced, the methods of displacing them are mostly illegal methods, intimidation, people that enjoy a rent that is fairly that is a fair price will have all kinds of tactics from landlords to raise the rent. And there's all the process of gentrification on people that are there, that maybe at the end of the day their rent is higher, and then you have the question of, well, should we give them a rent supplement to pay? But the process of raising the rent is itself, there's a problem. I see a problem there. Before we get to the expensive taste analysis, we have a power relate. You know, it's only a question of landlord owners have more power to raise the rent of So I see
right.
the problem
no,
there.
I follow you. I mean, the distinction I made between process and outcomes was really, what I wanted to get at there is we may well decide that exclusion is not a harm, that displacement is a harm, and that displacement is not occurring, because there are quite a few studies that suggest displacement is quite limited, although of course it varies depending on what the regulatory regime is. So I'm sure it's happening someplace, but where there's a great deal of public housing and where there's laws regulating tenancy or high levels of home ownership, it happens much less. So even if that's the case, so no individual has been harmed, let's say according to the analysis, it still might be possible that the outcome, a polarized city, a homogeneous city, is something that we see as a problem, as something that we are against for democratic reasons, for reasons like Frank talked about in his analysis of civic virtues, for example. So that's what I was getting at. You're right, I don't, you know, within displacement, disaggregate, you know, is this harmful when the landlords use illegal tactics or, you know, exploit power relations as opposed to, you know, some other mechanism. And that would be interesting to really examine and to delve more into the displacement.
This question may or may not bear in your argument, but this is just a thought. I'm not totally sold that, if I understood you correctly, that living downtown is an expensive taste because you have no commuting cost, essentially. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying downtown is an expensive taste because it's expensive to live downtown because it costs more.
Okay.
And this might not be true everywhere, but I mean, in sort of classic cases of gentrification, you know, central urban downtown neighborhoods are more expensive to live than inner city suburbs. I mean, that's certainly true in, you know, in Toronto, which this is
yeah.
in Canada.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the rent for a two-bedroom apartment in Scarborough is half what it is in downtown. So it's an expensive taste just because it's more expensive.
Okay. I guess my question would be, would it change your analysis at all if you concluded that the prices attached to these things are distorted, they don't really reflect the actual social cost of what's going on? So the person living downtown is actually, for instance, contributing far less carbon footprint because they're walking instead of using cars. Or if you contend that there is some sort of social benefit from these mixed neighborhoods, maybe there's some benefit that, and in fact, people are being overpriced for living downtown. They should be getting a discount for not using their car, for creating these social benefits by creating integrated neighborhoods. Would that change your argument at all? Or is that just an irrelevant aside?
Well, I mean, I don't think it would change my argument. I mean, I think it suggests what you're arguing is that maybe, you know, market prices are not really the true prices because of externalities. I think that's absolutely correct. So I'm sympathetic to Jerry Cohn, who's arguing against the idea of market prices being just. So while that isn't an argument that I made, the idea that market prices aren't just sort of strengthens the argument, because ultimately it says that, what I'm arguing against is a position like Dworkin's, which is the market sets prices fairly, and as long as people have equal or fair resources to begin with, then things will be allocated in a way that's just. And I think that's not true, and Cohn thinks that's not true because he thinks market prices are not fair, just prices in all cases. And there may be times to rely on them because the efficiency benefits outweigh the harms from a standpoint of justice. It's not as if, you know, I would say that we can throw them out altogether, but when we are going to evaluate them from a normative perspective, I would say that, you know, that they're not good enough. Now you're suggesting that also from the standpoint of efficiency, they're not good enough. And I think that's true. I mean, in practice, I think often, I mean, in the Toronto case, people in the suburbs are relying on public transit and they're not relying on cars. It's not the sort of typical, elite vision of the car-based suburbs that are generating all these environmental costs. I mean, the suburbs are often inner-city suburbs that are very high density, and so that might not be exactly applicable in that case, but in other cases, it absolutely is.
So I said this to you before you started, but there are lots of cities that be desperate for gentrification, and so I'm not defending gentrification as you've described it, but I think the big question is what that, and I think this mostly has to do with housing, what kind of housing policy you have in the region. And by that, what I mean is, are the poor chasing the rich in the metropolitan area, or the rich chasing the poor? Gentrification is when the rich are chasing the poor and then pushing them out. exclusionary suburbs are a reaction to the poor trying to chase the rich. That is, that would what you would predict if the housing market were really open, say in the suburbs. The poor would chase the rich to get better services, and then the rich would try to move away from them, and then the poor would chase the rich. Here we have the reverse, which is the rich are chasing the poor. One question is whether to just stop that cycle, you figure out a fair share regime in both places so that there is a mix, and whether there is a right to a mix of housing. So, for example, the New Jersey Supreme Court in the 70s said there's a right to there's an obligation on municipalities to provide a meaningful mix of housing, and that may be the answer to that. The other thing I just would say is I'm not quite convinced of the exclusion argument unless you in the context of a metropolitan area that actually had a relatively free market in housing, which there are very few that do. So the displacement argument is a better one, but to the extent that that's not occurring, it seems that undermines the critique of gentrification. And then you'd have to justify the displacement argument, the displacement critique. And I assume that's based on a reliance interest of some kind, that is, long tenure in a place establishes attachments which are painful and damaging to undermine. So just two comments.
So those are, I think I have four that I wrote down here, interesting comments. First of all, I guess I wanted to draw attention to the way you phrased your first comment, cities are desperate for gentrification. I think that that's true. And even in Toronto, the planners and the people in government tend to see gentrification as a positive thing, maybe not using that term, but revitalization, renewal, renaissance, things like that. But just because cities are in favor of it because it would increase the tax base doesn't mean that the local residents are. And I would guess that, you know, I've lived in the sort of rural South myself, that, you know, those residents don't necessarily always want gentrification because it does lead to higher prices and it does lead to a change in the character of the neighborhood and institutions and commercial spaces. And so I think that we can't really generalize. Well, I mean, you can generalize about cities if you're talking about the government, but different people within them are going to be in favor of them and against them. So I do think it's kind of a complicated story there. As far as, you know, what drives this process, I mean, I'm convinced by Neil Smith's argument about the rent gap. I know there have been some studies suggesting that that doesn't tell the whole story, but I mean, I think there is something about areas where disinvestment then, you know, provides an opportunity for capital and for, you know, increased values and for people to profit by them, and I think that is at least part of the story. I mean, I think there is a cultural side of it also. I don't see them as opposed. As far as your suggestion that the solution might be instead to provide public goods more fairly across different areas, yes, that is in fact what I argue in the paper, that, I mean, Hayek does have a point that if you subsidize something, then and it's something that lots of people want, you're going to have demand for it, and not everybody is going to be able to live in a brownstone downtown. And so one solution to that is to think about, why is it that people want to live downtown? Is it public transit? Is it a certain, you know, design of a neighborhood? Or is it access to public amenities? I think schools are a big part of the story in lots of places. And then you really have to think about how to equalize access to those things. So there have been studies that show there are less recreational amenities in Scarborough, so this inner suburban part of Toronto, than there are downtown, and they are trying to rectify that. But I do think you also have to have school assignment, which is not based on residence. So I think that is also really important. And then you mentioned that you were not convinced that exclusion is a problem. I agree with that. I'm afraid I went over the paper so quickly that it wasn't really clear what conclusion I reached on each of these harms. I listed the harms because these are harms that are identified through the secondary literature. But it's really only displacement that I think is clearly that there's a very strong sort of philosophical, theoretical case to be made. And I think displacement does not occur as often as people in the literature assume, but I think it does occur, and when it occurs, it is harmful. Exclusion, I mean, for the reasons I said, that an expensive taste is a taste that, you know, is different for reasons that we can identify, does not justify seeing exclusion as being a harm. And that means that the case, I think, is not as strong. Does it mean that there's no case? I would not go that far. I think that there are harms there also. I mean, and one of them is unfair access to public goods. I think that's a very serious one. And that also applies for exclusion to the suburbs, because in fact, in gentrifying neighborhoods downtown, the schools usually aren't that good, so it's not being driven that by that. But exclusion from some of these elite suburbs, there is access to a very sought-after public good that you're being excluded from, and that, I think, is a reason for distinguishing between those two cases.
Thanks, that was a great paper. I just want to question your use of luck egalitarianism, and in part maybe you can just sort of explain it to me a little bit more. And my concern here is that the language or the idea of luck itself is places the issue too squarely on the shoulders of the individual. It's not really about luck. These are much larger structural problems that have nothing to do with individuals. So just the language of luck itself seems to sort of misplace our analysis, and then we have to go through figuring out, you know, an individual's taste and whether or not that's fair or just. But again, this isn't at all about individuals. These are large structural problems and huge ideological prejudices. So, for example, in the case of global justice, it's actually not bad luck of anybody who's born in a poor country. It's a long history of colonialism that's really the issue.
No, that's a great comment. I really appreciate that, because I do feel like the terms that are used in this literature and which I adopt are in a way deeply misleading, like expensive tastes, right? I mean, the examples are like plover's eggs, and yes. For the longest time in my mind, I was pronouncing it a fine claret, but apparently it's a claret. I know so little about wine, I don't even know what you call fine wine, but I mean, those are the examples, and if you read it kind of superficially, it seems really absurd, and that's why. But I feel like, in fact, what Jerry Cohn is getting at there is a very profound and compelling critique of the justice of the market. But it's being expressed in a language that I almost feel like I'm turning into some sort of Straussian, that you need to do this esoteric reading to see that that's really what he's intending there. And it's the same thing with the term luck. Yes, that could imply something that seems like, you know, the role of a roulette wheel. But in fact, it's structural inequality that they're getting at. That luck means it's something that you as an individual are not responsible for, and that it's not something that can be explained in terms of individual choices, but instead structures that you're embedded in. So it is very much a kind of structural harm of the type Iris Marion Young is writing about in the book that we're going to be reading for our group. And yet there is this language that doesn't convey that initially. And so I think it's thank you for giving me an opportunity to emphasize that.
Differential rent that was brought up earlier about where you live and where you work, and you know that both you and I are completely counter market here. In fact, Peggy works in the Far East End in an older suburb, lives in the West End. I live in the East End of Toronto and work in the far northwest of the city because our universities are in the suburbs, which means that actually we one up your argument by living very far away and pay a premium for where we live, and we gentrify the other part of the city where we shouldn't live. So there is that aspect to it too. My question though is to perhaps in line with the last question about the more collective view of things, how do you factor in what your colleague Sue Bunce calls state-led gentrification, where there's and you already commented on revitalization as one of those things that have a high value in the public discourse in Toronto. So how do you factor that in as a concerted effort by the state to make gentrification a goal?
Mm-hmm. Yes, thank you for that question, because I mean, one thing that I didn't point out and I think is very important is that we tend to see gentrification purely in terms of the market, whether it's the decision made by individual families like, you know, myself to kind of invest in, live in an area where, you know, you can get into the housing market and the hope it's going to appreciate, or large developers who are going to take advantage of, you know, areas that are considered blighted in order to get land at reasonable prices and develop condo towers. But there is a role that's played by the state here, and part of it can also be through policing, through through the regulation of public uses. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to talk that much about this slide up here, the transformation of public and social space. But I do think that there is a kind of interaction here between gentrifiers and government. And so one example would be that, you know, when gentrifiers move in, they will mobilize to ensure that bars do not get their liquor license renewed. So these kind of social spaces for poor people who live in single room occupancy hotels, those are closed down. The police will come and, you know, tell people not to loiter. They'll drive them out of public parks, or even there'll be like a change in the programming of public parks or in the design of parks in order to discourage people, homeless people or poor people from using them. And I think it's very important to recognize that it's not just about individual preferences, but it's about certain people having more power, and that gentrifiers can use that power in order to remake neighborhoods into the kind of public and social spaces that they envision and feel comfortable in. So that's a very important role. As far as the broader issue of the collusion between the urban regimes and developers, I mean, that's not something that I've worked on, but I really like Jason Hackworth's book, The Neoliberal City, that I think documents the way projects like the revitalization, so-called revitalization of Regent Park, and even more so the Hope 6 projects in the United States, are essentially land grabs that take areas that had been longstanding public housing communities, and then under the guise of mixed income and social mix, end up displacing residents and making this land available to the market. Now, in the case of Regent Park in Toronto, as I understand it, you know, from people in TCHC, Toronto Community Housing Corporation, there was a strong commitment not to displace anybody, a guarantee that everybody would be rehoused on the same site. And so I think arguments like the one that I'm trying to make here about the value of embeddedness in communities and a kind of a right to place are hopefully the types of arguments that convince people like that. And that makes a big difference when you have a situation like in Chicago and Cabrini Green, where people are permanently displaced, as opposed to the one in Toronto where they had a commitment to rehouse them all. I do think that makes a difference. And so there I see the normative argument as having an impact. Well, I should say the political mobilization around a normative argument. The normative argument alone doesn't have that impact, of course.
Well, this is a comment that might it's to throw something into the mix, but it also might, maybe, if I got the structure of the argument right, it might lead you to see that there is something city-specific with respect to polarization. So in downtown Toronto, the councillor that represents this ward, I meant to talk about him yesterday, Vaughan, notes that Toronto's economy is largely based on service. It's a service service-based economy, and the servants, a huge proportion of them, have been displaced by gentrification, and they live far from the center of the city, but therefore they have to commute to get to the center of the city. So he wants there to be inclusionary zoning bylaws, both to have family-friendly and also low-cost or supported housing downtown, so that, among other things, the people who are, you know, the waitresses and the, you know, all of the different service workers, or a lot of them, can live close to where they work. And his arguments are partly in terms of fairness. You know, why should they have to pay more to get to work? So it's kind of displacement in the other direction, but also efficiency. It's remarkably inefficient, and you can demonstrate it in terms of travel time and in terms of just actual health, and never mind environmental questions and the tax on the transit system to have service workers living so far from where they work. Those seem to me to be good arguments.
Right, but you're making an argument in favor of polarization. So when scholars say polarization is a harm, what they're identifying is the fact that in the 1960s, a neighborhood was a homogeneously working class neighborhood. And then as wealthy people move into the area, you have poor people and rich people living side by side. It's polarized. So you have high income people and low income people. And that's what you have in a lot of downtown Toronto neighborhoods. Not all of them. I mean, certainly like Yorkville, there's neighborhoods that gentrified so completely that they're now elite enclaves. But most of the neighborhoods have both. So my neighborhood would be an example of that, right? A fairly high income earner there, and there's a lot of really, really poor people.
Okay, no, I misunderstood your use of the word polarization. I thought it meant by regions of the city.
So what I'm arguing then, it's my fault because, there's a lot of different arguments in the paper, and I didn't present them, and I didn't present that one really at all. So people like Alan Walkes in this, I think, very interesting empirical paper documenting the trends of gentrification in Vancouver, Montreal, and Toronto, identifies polarization as a harm, the fact that you have high-income people and low-income people. And I don't see that as harmful. I see that as maybe even beneficial for reasons that you said, and possibly beneficial for other democratic reasons, that if you're going to have income inequality, which, I'm against, then it's better for people to know that and to see that and to think about it and confront it and experience it and work through it in daily life. Rather than to just simply, be unaware of it. And Iris Marin Young had a very interesting article about segregation where she examines this and says, on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with having enclaves of sort of similarly situated people, but you don't want the segregation to be so extreme that, one, that it prevents people from fair access to public goods, but also that, elite people have simply no exposure to what being poor is actually like or to poor people. And so, I wouldn't go so far as to say income polarization is a good thing, but I think there are good things about it. It would be better to have equality in general, but if you don't have equality, it might be better to have diverse neighborhoods of high and low earners rather than to have ghettos and elite enclaves.
Understood. The point is that bringing efficiency into it, if Vaughn is right, then there's an argument that duty and interest could coincide.
Okay, so my question is about bad price luck. And correct me if I'm wrong, you said that poor people who remain in high income areas are victims of bad price luck, and as such they should be compensated so that they're able to live in those more expensive areas. My question is that if such compensation is unqualified, in that there are no limits as to who will be compensated. Essentially my concern is that anyone who experiences so-called bad price luck or anyone who desires to live in an area that they cannot afford, how do we judge who?
Okay, thank you. First of all, I should be a little bit more precise. I did say that, but I think I meant tenants, because of course if you're a poor person who's a homeowner, you're not really a victim of bad price luck, you're kind of a beneficiary of the rising prices. I mean, some people do complain that property taxes are increasing and that's going to force them out. I have little sympathy for this argument. When you own an $800,000 house, I feel that you can cover these taxes through some sort of reverse mortgage. So I'm really thinking of tenants in that situation. So as far as who should be compensated here, I think it is very important to distinguish between long-term residents who have this topophilia, who have memory, who have history. What was it someone said, the je ne sais quoi, the unspeakable of place. I mean, it's hard to articulate what it is. I think there is a practical side of it. I think networks of mutual aid are very important. I mean, in my own life, I rely very much on neighbors to pick up my kids from school, and we have networks walking them down to school, and it would be very hard to be a professional person without those things, and to rebuild them is very, very hard, and there's very real cost. So I think that there is a psychological, there's a kind of phenomenological side to it, and there is also a very logistical and practical side to it. So I think those people are differently situated in clear and identifiable ways from people from the outside who would just like to live there because, they think it's sort of cool. And so I do think exclusion and displacement are normatively different. I think there can be arguments like the one that Frank made about why exclusion is bad also, but I think that the arguments are not the same and that they're stronger in terms of displacement. Now, as far as who should be compensated, I mean, what I have in mind here in the sufficient landia example is that, people, their rent subsidy would increase so that it could kind of keep pace with the increase in the cost of the neighborhood. Now, that's a sort of abstract example to illustrate a normative point. I mean, in fact, you could say, then landlords could just keep raising their rent because the government would have to pay for it, and this could involve all sorts of weird collusion and corruption, and it could be really costly. But, not to sort of take the easy philosopher's way out, but I mean, I think it's kind of trying to illustrate a normative principle, and then we have to think about how it would actually be applied. I expected I would get a question from someone like, well, if you're in favor of expensive taste, then should we be subsidizing, you know, people who really like caviar, and should we be paying for, you know, ski hills, and does everybody have a right to go on like a European tour or something like that? Because that would seem to be a kind of logical consequence of the argument. But again, and this goes back to Catherine's point, I mean, I think that these illustrations are kind of exaggeration for effect, to show us that a simple market allocation is not good enough. Yet we can't fulfill all of these expensive tastes. That would be impossible and it would be unwise. So given that, we have to deliberate as a society and then decide which are things that are going to be prioritized over others. And so I do think that neighborhood stability is something that we would see as legitimately something to pursue in the name of justice. How to do that, it doesn't really necessarily involve giving people vouchers of money. You can do it through regulation, right? So one way would be to, you know, make it difficult to evict people or to raise the rent. That already exists in Ontario. You can't increase the rent more than the inflation index as long as the same tenant is in a unit. And so I think that is a really good idea, and that is stabilizing. So that's then, well, Martin might disagree with me putting it in these terms, but this is kind of putting the costs over to the side of the landlord, and it's not borne by the state then. So, but that's another way of accomplishing that same goal. Public housing is another way of doing that. So this would be, you know, a way to make the argument against Case Oates and the Toronto Community Housing Corporation for saying that simply that we need to sell these units and rehouse people in these peripheral areas where it's cheaper. And that goes on everywhere. I mean, in New York City and Battery Park City, initially they were going to have one-third public housing in Battery Park City, which is a high-income area in Manhattan. And then they said, well, you know, if we give this land to developers for market-rate housing, we can actually house twice as many people in the Bronx, so let's do that. And that was, in the end, what they did. So I think this type of decision is being made constantly. So even if we're not giving vouchers to people, it provides a kind of normative argument in favor of not simply deferring to a kind of efficiency market-based rationale, which is the temptation. Yes, so this is exactly what I had in mind in the section on is there a group right? Is there a ethnogeography? Oh, I just went blank now. But is there a specific ethnogeography, by which I mean a specific culturally specific conception of land, which then could justify territorial rights? So territorial rights would be the ability of communities to, yes, exclude certain people in order to maintain a kind of ethos. And this is the kind of argument that some people, you know, make. If you want to have a working class neighborhood, if you want to have an arts community, you really have to exclude commodification, or you have to exclude certain kinds of developments. And I reject that argument for precisely the reasons that you say. It can, those exact same mechanisms, and in fact the exact same rationale, theoretically, can be used to exclude people, whether it's elite neighborhoods excluding you know, ethnic minorities, poor people, different forms of tenancy, or downtown neighborhoods limiting density, that has the potential to have these negative effects. And so we can't really justify that strong sub-municipal group right. I still do find the idea of an ethnogeographic community kind of useful in just understanding people's sense of loss and harm, because you have areas that were basically abandoned by capital, you know, are sort of derelict, and then people come in there in order to develop use values, not planning on capitalizing on it in any way. They don't own it, they don't have secure tenancy, but they build works of arts, they build these communities, they build these institutions. And that is only enabled because, you know, of capital flight. And as soon as wealthier people want back in, this is totally destroyed. And so I don't want to say that everybody in these poor neighborhoods has anti-capitalist values, right? That's not true. But there are places where a different value system can root itself, and that is precarious then, and that's lost. So I think the ethnogeographic conception enables us to see that. This, some neighborhoods are like heterotopias, places where you can live differently outside of the logic of capital, but they're never that simple. There's always really conflicting and diverse understandings of property and motives for profit. And so you have to have some sort of more democratic mechanism for taking into account not just the interests of people in the neighborhood, but the people who are excluded and who are outside.
Great. Thanks so much.